The car needed an enormous amount of repairs, expensive repairs, and I couldn't justify keeping it anymore.
Which is why Barbara Rimkunas of Exeter decided to donate her beloved 2002 Volvo to NHPR.
What was better than to donate it to New Hampshire Public Radio, because they produced my favorite podcast in the whole world, Civics 101.
You too can support your favorite NHPR programs when you donate your old car today at nhpr.org/car donation.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Until recently, the state of New Hampshire had a backlog of more than 30,000 unprocessed driver notifications. The Concord School Board faces pressure to remove the capital city's high school principal and district superintendent for their handling of sexual misconduct allegations. And we're about 6 months away from the 2020 primary, and the crowded field of candidates just got a little bit smaller. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them in this hour. If you've got questions about the week's news, send them by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions, our senior political reporter Kevin Landrigan of the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here today.
Great to be back, Peter.
Hey, Peter.
And listeners, just a reminder that you can also watch a live streaming video of this radio broadcast. Just head on over to our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word on Facebook, and you can watch the video there. We learned this week that the state has had a backlog of more than 30,000 unprocessed driver infractions. And Kevin, you've been covering this for the Union Leader.
I have.
The governor held a press conference about this, which you attended. What did you learn about this backlog?
Well, one thing we should talk about is just why are we looking at this backlog? It's really because of the awful tragedy that happened up in Randolph on June 21st when 7 motorcyclists were killed. The driver of a flatbed trailer, Vladimir Zhukovsky from West Springfield, Massachusetts, shouldn't have been on the road at the time. His license, he had been arrested for drunk driving in Connecticut in May. So that uncovered a scandal in Massachusetts. There were boxes of driver license suspension notices that sat in a warehouse in Quincy that had not been acted upon, including Zhukovsky's license. As a result, the Registrar of Motor Vehicles was stepped down under fire. A number of people down there have stepped down. And then the governor in this state, Chris Sununu, ordered this review. And the review found that, sure enough, for decades, it's been institutional that there's been a backlog of suspension notices or actual actions that should have been taken against drivers.
So these are people who maybe they've gotten a DUI or some other driving infraction, and the state has determined that they should lose their license, but the state hadn't gotten around to notifying them in some way or officially taking their license away. Is that what we're talking about?
That's correct. There's really 3 actions here. There were 7 commercial truck drivers whose license should have been suspended and weren't. There were 904 where they had infractions in other states that called for the suspension of their driving license, and that hadn't happened. And then we had another collection of about 2,800 in which driver suspensions occurred as a result of defaulting on court cases. You didn't pay your speeding ticket, or a shoplifting offense. You didn't carry out the punishment you should. Under statute, we routinely did this, meaning we routinely, in our state laws, tie the driving privileges to complying with court actions because it's the most stringent way to get people to act. And so as a result, that's almost 4,000 suspensions of both in-state and out-of-state drivers. But Governor Sununu said it was like night and day compared to the scandal in Massachusetts. The Registrar of Motor Vehicles had been aware of the backlog that had been existing and had been working to reduce it when the tragedy occurred.
And at this press conference, Safety Commissioner Robert Quinn explained some of what the state discovered during its review. Here's what he had to say.
During this review, no stone was left unturned. While we can say today that there is no current notification backlog within the New Hampshire DMV, that was not always the case. The review uncovered a long history of New Hampshire DMV manual processing falling behind. This dated back decades. It became clear that there was a history of not being able to catch up on time. No single individual was responsible. This pattern of tardiness dates back to prior administrations and commissioners. The DMV has now eliminated that culture. Governor Sununu has instructed the DMV to not accept any more backlogs, and the Department of Safety and the DMV will be sending the governor monthly reports on updated numbers to hold us accountable moving forward.
And Quinn also said that the department had been addressing the backlog beginning more than 2 years ago with the installation of a new electronic system that allows for automated entry of records. He also said that despite the backlog, DMV staff had never, quote, abandoned the notices. Dean, your thoughts?
Yes, that piece of sound laid out the issue quite nicely. State and federal bureaucracies are not known for being cutting edge in their technology. And so Governor Sununu's argument has been that this is really a function of the manual inputting of these notifications rather than some sort of negligence. In the Massachusetts case, there was discussion of boxes of records just being put aside and ignored. And so as you heard there, the issue is they're going to move to this more automated system, and that should help with the backlog. But their argument is that they never took their eye off of the ball. They just had difficulty catching up. And in the end, that comes down to an issue of resources, having the funding, having the training, because if you put in these automated systems and people don't know how to input the data properly, then you run into additional issues of notifications falling through the cracks. So we'll see if this continues. My guess is if you looked at DMVs around the country, you would see very similar kind of bureaucratic backlog. So Sununu's argument is that this is an issue of intent. They've been aware of the backlog. It's the issue was the manual inputting of the data, not some sort of negligence where stuff was put in a box and put under a desk.
Kevin.
I was just going to say, important note here. Director of Motor Vehicles, Elizabeth Bilecki, made it clear because they went through all of these suspensions, and there weren't any fatalities on the highways that resulted from any of these suspensions, unlike what happened in Massachusetts with Zukofsky.
They analyzed each case to make sure?
They did. And they say there were no highway fatalities that occurred as a result of those motorists still being on the road. Another thing to point out is that, as Dean just alluded to, this is a national problem. The American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators is working on it and trying to put together a nationwide database that could allow all states to share real-time information about all their suspensions. So all of these paper records would be redundant. And that system, New Hampshire hopes to have up and running. New Hampshire hopes to join by June of 2021.
And another issue here is that, as you mentioned, while it's a relief that there were no fatalities resulting from the backlog, that's great until your luck runs out. And at some point, if they don't catch up on the backlog, as happened in Massachusetts, something really tragic could happen. So yeah, it really is imperative that they catch up on this.
So is there any transparency on the audit that was done and what's going to be needed going forward financially from the state? I mean, is the government, A, disclosing how much this recent audit cost, and B, how much it might cost to staff up so it can stay on top? I mean, I know they said it was going to be an automated system of some kind, but it stands to reason that they may need more staff too. And is the government saying anything about that?
We've asked for that information at the press conference. They did not have a cost of the audit, and they're putting together the cost for staffing to, on a routine basis, eliminate this institutional backlog. Because we've always suspected that that's why backlogs have existed for decades. That let's keep in mind, until this tragedy happened, Governor Sununu's in the middle of his second term. He wasn't aware a backlog existed. It was just kind of routine business that directors of motor vehicles were to manage their budgets. At any one point, even in this small state, the Division of Motor Vehicles is managing 100,000 license suspensions in New Hampshire. So it is a... As Dean alluded to, it is a system of triage. You try and make sure you're acting on the worst actors, so God forbid tragedies like Randolph don't happen.
Yeah, and the problem is that you don't know you have a problem until you have a problem.
That's right.
In a lot of these kind of bureaucratic situations.
Is that the case for Massachusetts? Did they not know that this would have happened, something like that?
I'm not sure what understanding there was in advance of the problem. In the Massachusetts case, as I understand it, they were basically neglecting boxes full of records. So
But did they know they were neglecting it? Were they working on it? Or was it just something that they become complacent about?
No,
go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's why the director resigned. And I think that's why the head of the rating board was fired. I think there was some recognition, but there was no action plan to take care of it.
And I don't recall anyone saying, oh, no, it's just a backlog. We've been processing these regularly. This literally seemed like these records were just kind of put aside and ignored.
Yeah, institutionally ignored.
So there's one issue I do want to talk about before we move on to something tangentially related, which is that the state has blamed, in part, privacy laws prohibiting it from sharing information between states. This has been reported in a few different places, but former State Rep Neil Kirk, who's known as a fierce advocate for privacy, had something to say about this in the Union Leader. What was his comments, more or less?
He did. He indicated that that it isn't the fault of the privacy law, that the statute in question doesn't prevent the has been cited here, doesn't prevent the Department of Motor Vehicles from providing a named individual or a reasonable number identifiable to another government agency. Here is the problem, is our statute, as Neil Kirk's letter to the Union Leader indicates, prevents the transfer of a complete or substantially complete extract of a motor vehicle record. That means institutionally you can't share all of those records. The long-term steps in this white paper internal review from Governor Sununu starts with the DMV recommends legislative changes to allow the DMV to participate in the state-by-state driver verification system. The governor said at the press conference that routinely the state is not able to share state-by-state records except for the Real ID records. And that's because the federal government in the Real ID law requires all of those Real ID records to be put on a national database so that they can follow all of these people nationwide. As we know, Real ID is not, we're not fully compliant with it yet. Some estimates are 3 out of 4 drivers still don't have a Real ID license. They're going to have to by October of 2020. But Governor Sununu has said we need to change our statute to require all of our driver records to be real-time shared state by state.
Also in the news this week regarding the DMV, a woman in eastern New Hampshire received a notice this week that she needed to surrender her vanity license plate. It was the letters PB, the number 4, and the words "we go." So P before we go. And she was told to surrender it after sporting it on her car for 15 years because it made a reference to an execratory act, which is against the law. Kevin, there is some backstory here about how the state figures out what's suitable and what's not suitable on a license plate. So before we dive into the details of P before we go, how does the state decide stuff like this?
Well, it has both standard and recall procedures that have been in place since July of 2018. But even further back than that, the Division of Motor Vehicles has had broad powers to essentially reject any vanity plate they consider to be in bad taste. And in general, if it refers to bodily functions in any way or offensive, potentially violent material in any way, then the DMV could reject it. We had a pretty celebrated case prior to this one in which a man wanted the right to have a license plate that read "Cops Lie" as his license. The DMV rejected that. It went all the way to the New Hampshire Supreme Court, which upheld the division's right to turn down that plate.
Okay. And regarding this case, the woman's name is Wendy Auger. Her plight was publicized. She was in the press saying, this is kind of ridiculous. I wish I could keep this plate. And then Governor Chris Sununu stepped in and gave her a call and said, hey, we're going to strongly encourage the DMV to let you keep it, and that's what's going to happen. She's going to keep this plate.
Yeah, she's going to be allowed to keep her plate. And, you know, her argument was anybody who's had children has told them before a long trip, go use the bathroom so we don't have to stop while we're on the trip. I've been in that position myself many times. You know, these vanity plates are just a source of fascination by the general public everywhere. I think it was the Concord Monitor had an interactive feature a while back where you could look at all the plates that were rejected. And part of the challenge here is that, as, you know, colloquialisms and slang change over the decades, you have to have people in position who understand kind of the changing nature of these plates, because a lot of times people try to slip things through and come up with really clever elocutions that somebody at the DMV may not catch. And so this one is particularly interesting because she did have the plate for 15 years. And, it, you know, these kinds of stories just get tremendous coverage. I believe I saw this like a couple national outlets picked up this story as well, just because it's kind of people think it's interesting and kind of clever.
Yeah, and there is a political angle to this, or maybe there isn't. I'll let you both be the judge of that. But, you know, for the governor to step in on this, on a DMV-related issue, during a week where the DMV is getting some negative press, is this kind of a distraction? Is this a look over here at this other DMV story kind of issue?
You could interpret it that way. I have no insight into whether or not this was an intentional strategy to take people's eye off of the notification issues. But it certainly, as I said, it certainly gets a lot of attention. Unfortunately, probably more attention than something like the DMV notification story would get, just because people are so fascinated by the whole tug of war of trying to get a vanity plate through a state bureaucracy.
Well, listeners, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're talking about the week's news. If you have questions about it or comments, send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Let's talk about the budget. It's been more than 2 months since Governor Sununu vetoed the budget. Negotiators have yet to come up with a deal. Meanwhile, school is starting, and poorer communities that had been counting on extra money in the Democrat-passed budget are feeling kind of anxious about how they're going to get what they need for students. So, Kevin, what are lawmakers disagreeing on right now?
Well, there's a whole host of disagreements that are holding up this budget. And one of them certainly is the level of education aid. The two-year state budget that the governor vetoed contained a $138 million increase in education aid. That would be the largest in 20 years. We're also arguing about the business tax cuts that took effect in January. There was a second round of business tax cuts. Democrats running the legislature say they're not affordable. They could blow as much as $100 million hole in the next budget. The governor says they've been critical to the economic recovery and the revenue increases that have occurred. We also have Medicaid provider rates that are very important to healthcare providers all over the state. The legislature wants to give all Medicaid providers a rate increase of 3.1%. The governor has said, I support raising some provider rates, but I think it should be on an as-need basis. And I think some providers deserve more than 3%. So he wants his administration to have flexibility on deciding who gets the proprietor rate changes.
Yeah, this entire budget standoff really is a kind of a classic version of the ideological split between Republicans and Democrats over taxing and spending.
Yes.
The level, what should the level of business taxes be? Can they be rolled back, or are they essential to continue growing the economy? And how much money should be spent? And what kind of mandate? You know, Governor Sununu is making an argument that you know, there may be situations in which he would be willing to give one-time grants for things like education. But his concern, and Republicans often voice this, is about creating unfunded mandates in which you start, because of a sort of a surplus funds at a given moment, you start funding additional programs. And then at some point when that funding goes away, then there's additional pressure to come up with that money. So this entire standoff can really be viewed through the lens of fundamental disagreements about how much to spend, how permanent should that increase in spending be, and what should be the level of taxes? What's the appropriate level of taxes? And as we've seen, these revenue estimates drop now by, I think there's going to be about an $86 million gap projected now for the going forward. That just intensifies this and puts more pressure on both parties. You know, we'll see. You know, at some point, perhaps there'll be a compromise, but we know this is putting a lot of pressure on groups and organizations and institutions that depend on state funding. Certainly, it's been a big issue with education, as we've seen this week.
Yeah, let's hear from one of those people, Frank Sprague, chair of the Claremont School Board. During the public hearing on the effects of this continuing resolution this week, he expressed real disappointment with it. Here's him.
We in Claremont watched with considerable excitement as the prospect of the positive changes that were coming forward in state funding for education. This would have been transformational for us in Claremont. For once, we would have been able to not cut staff. We would have been able to actually reduce a crushing tax burden that we have on our taxpayers. And for that, the efforts of those senators and legislatures that worked on that to bring that possibility to us, we are very, very grateful. That excitement died quite suddenly with a stroke of the pen, and with the governor's veto, and then the lack of will to confront that governor's veto.
Sprague said the district is facing cuts of at least $500,000, likely involving cuts to programming and staffing. That's on top of cuts in previous years. And if you heard NHPR's Sarah Gibson story on the Berlin School District this week, you'll hear that, you know, they're suffering in a big way as well. They don't have a chemistry teacher at their high school, and that's related to this. So it's a big deal, Kevin, that the schools are really sort of feeling the pinch, especially as the school year starts.
No, it is. It is a big deal. And some of this is about this vetoed budget, and some of this is systemic. And that is, you know, as we've seen with this latest education funding lawsuit in the Conval School District, the continued reliance on a property tax has essentially meant that that cities and towns have been unable to keep up with the rising costs of the costs of public education. And that's why these superintendents, these school board members, students all came to this hearing to essentially say, we need you to deliver on the promises that were in that vetoed state budget. But as Dean alluded to, these latest revenue estimates really make that problematic and probably not likely that education aid is probably going to take a haircut from what was in the vetoed state budget in order to make a final deal.
And you typically hear about the issue of unfunded mandates with regard to the federal government. The federal government imposing new requirements on state governments. We've seen that over the years, and state governments resisting what they view as a short-term infusion of funds followed by a decrease in funding that leads to them then having to foot the bill. What's interesting about this is you're seeing that same kind of ideological debate play out at the state level between Republicans and Democrats. And, you know, we're going into an election year, and, you know, Governor Sununu is running for re-election. You know, Dan Felty is a leader in the Senate, may very well run for governor as a Democrat. And so there's a potential for some real difficult politics to negotiate here.
Difficult in the sense that Senator Feltes doesn't have that much of an incentive to give Sununu a victory here?
Or you want to be able to go to your voters and say, hey, you know, if you're a Democrat, you want to be able to say, the governor vetoed these programs. I'm fighting for you. We need a Democratic governor. If you're a Republican governor, you know, Governor Sununu, I think, has issued 53 vetoes. It's like three times the number we've seen. And he can go to his constituencies and say, you know, the Democrats are spending like there's no tomorrow. I'm holding the line. They want to roll back business tax cuts, which I believe are essential to growing the economy. And so it's just this fundamental ideological divide that's really firing up for the election season.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about the pressure the Concord School Board is facing to remove the capital city's superintendent of schools and the high school principal over discontent over the way that they handled allegations of sexual misconduct in the district. So we'll talk about that. If you've got questions or comments, send them by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Nina Totenberg. Are you someone who talks about how great public radio is, but you're still not a donor? Rather than wait for the next pledge drive, you can support the programs you love by donating that unwanted vehicle. It could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station, and you could get a tax deduction. Or you could just give us hundreds of dollars directly. We'd like that a lot. And thank you.
Learn more about donating your old car or truck at nhpr.org/cardonation.
On Thursday, on The Exchange, we'll be speaking with Democratic Congressman Chris Pappas. If you've got questions for him, send them by email now. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And right now, we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. In the studio with me, Kevin Landrigan, reporter for The Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. This week, the Concord School District, it's been holding public meetings and spending much of the summer working out new policies regarding how to handle sexual misconduct in its schools. It's had some issues with that. And so maybe I'll turn to you, Dean, for a little bit of context on what's been happening in Concord schools over the past few years and really coming to a head within the past 6 months or so.
Yeah, just to give a little background, we recently had the arrest of Primo Howie Lung, who is a teacher at Concord High School. He was arrested arrested and charged in Massachusetts for multiple sexual assaults against a middle schooler several years ago. He'd originally been a teacher in the middle school. He's since moved up to the high school. So this was going back. What precipitated his arrest was actually not the middle school assaults, but him being seen kissing a high school student who was actually 18, so it's a somewhat different issue. But there are high school policies about the interaction between teachers and students. So that led to an investigation, which then uncovered these other sexual assaults. And he remained on the faculty for about 3 months while the initial part of this story was breaking. And he's since been charged in Massachusetts courts with possible crimes. And so this has played out over the summer in Concord school system. There's an independent investigation going on right now. The Concord Monitor has been covering this story very closely. Yep. The Concord superintendent and school board have been very careful about what information they're able to put out. There have been a series of meetings to revise policies dealing with sexual harassment and student-teacher relationships. Most recently, a number of Concord residents started an online petition to remove the superintendent, Terry Forston, and the high school principal, Thomas Sicca.
And part of the reason why, forgive me for interrupting.
Unpaid leave right now, yeah.
Yeah, part of the reason why is because, over the past few years, the exact year escapes me, but other students have come forward about Howie Leung and said, hey, he's doing stuff that is not right.
And there have been other issues with how the school has responded to sexual harassment, assault, et cetera. Basically, this situation with Mr. Leung being seen kissing a high school student really kind of opened up a whole series of issues that have been percolating in the district for a while now. Some parents believe that the administration has not been responsive enough. The Concord School Board would ultimately decide whether to remove the superintendent, who's fairly new, and the principal, who was the junior high principal back at the time that Mr. Leung was assaulting the middle schooler. So there's kind of a
allegedly.
This goes back several years, allegedly, of course.
But why the petition now? I mean, this has been going on for a while. We've known about these allegations, and it's been an issue of some concern for a while. But this petition popped up recently.
Yeah, well, there's a number of things. There was a letter that the superintendent sent to faculty and staff that, said to talk more about all the positive aspects of the Concord School, Concord High School, and the school system, and kind of casting a little bit of disparagement on the media coverage of the story. And I think there's just a rising level of frustration from parents that there's not enough information not enough transparency and information. The school board says we have to wait for this independent report before we can make any final decisions.
Kevin,
I was just going to say that. I think the petition also arises from a belief among a lot of these parents and families that the Concord School District continues to be sort of tone deaf with regard to how they've responded to this. Let's take an excerpt from the letter that Superintendent Terry Forston wrote a week ago Friday to staff about training on harassment and mandatory reporting. This is her quote. The local newspaper and social media have offered a continual dribble of articles and posts that have presented singular perspectives and have negatively impacted some of the community's viewpoints of our schools and work. Now, breaking news today, the Concord Monitor reports Superintendent Forston, in the run-up to the September 3rd meeting where this vote of confidence could come up and there's going to be a lot of people there, has now apologized for that letter. And let me read from her apology, this follow-up letter she distributed to the Concord School Committee. I unfairly labeled media and social media coverage of the recent and historical events that have occurred in our district. More importantly, I did not mean for my words to be in any way dismissive or discouraging of our students and their experiences. Mm-hmm. So,
and that came after the Concord Monitor published a detailed editorial saying,
correct.
Essentially, the gist was, we asked you for comments. And you chose not to provide us comments.
Right, and their argument has been that for legal and privacy reasons, there's only so much that they can talk about. And parents are obviously, in, you know, not surprising, want greater transparency. And you know, this goes back to the way in which these initial complaints about the alleged behavior were handled. You know, the process by which the school eventually informs the State Board of Education and also the Concord Police to get involved and investigate it. And so there's just been there's concern about potential irregularities and how all of this has been handled. In the end, it's really about kind of the transparency or lack thereof about how this is being dealt with going forward.
And earlier this week, I spoke with Concord Monitor reporter Leah Willingham, who has been covering this extensively for the Monitor. And I asked her if parents had seemed satisfied with certain steps that the district has taken, because the district has taken some steps. Here's Leah Willingham.
I've kind of heard mixed messages on that. Parents really liked that they were able to participate and be involved in the process of revising policies. Over the summer, the district revised a number of policies dealing with reporting misconduct, sexual harassment, memorandum of understanding with the Concord School District, the Concord School District and Concord Police for reporting any potential behavior that they should be aware of happening at the school. So they really felt satisfied on being able to participate in some of those conversations. And the school board has held a number of meetings where the public has been able to weigh in. But I think people, again, were really discouraged by the tone of the letter that was sent out on Friday because they felt like, in a way, that the way the superintendent was talking about the conversations that had been going on around this kind of undermined some of the steps that they felt the district had taken to move forward.
And again, Superintendent Terry Forston did apologize for the upsetting comments in the Concord Monitor today. Dean?
Yeah, I mean, one thing, and I'm not sure, I can't recall if Kevin read it in his excerpt, but part of what upset parents was the letter from Superintendent Forston said, it's time to move on. And some folks said, well, no, it's not quite yet time to move on. There are more to be dealt with here. And so that kind of further inflamed unhappiness with how the school district was handling this.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Bob in Concord. Bob, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm calling because, to me, being here in Concord, one of the fundamental issues was the fact that there was a girl in the middle school, as I recall, who actually saw something, said something, ended up getting suspended for 3 days, and I have yet to find out what kind of adequate compensation has been provided by the school/school board to that family. And there's also another issue. This is not the single issue that has occurred at that school in the last 10 years. There's actually been a series of incidents that were reported either to the principal of the high school and or tried to be reported to the superintendent, things that were reported to the principal at the high school. There was no follow-up from my understanding and talking to several people about other abusive incidents.
So yeah, to your point, Bob, there have been issues that parents have raised, and they still feel they're not ready to move on from yet. Kevin, do Bob's comments ring true to you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, and Bob may be alluding to this, but there's also, unrelated to the Howie Long case, there's a federal lawsuit the district's facing from a former Concord High School student who says she was sexually assaulted by a classmate on a school bus in late 2017. And both the superintendent and Principal Sicca are defendants in that federal lawsuit. So this is the most celebrated case. This is the most, it appears, maybe most extreme case, but it's not the only case. And I think that's what has provided momentum to this petition drive.
Other stories we've been following this week here at NHPR, the ACLU of New Hampshire has won a settlement against the Northwood police for illegally detaining an immigrant last year. Giovanni Velasco Perea lives legally in the United States, and according to the ACLU, Northwood police arrested Perea on suspicion that he was in the country illegally and held him to confirm his status with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Governor Chris Sununu will nominate an associate state attorney general as the next chair of the Public Utilities Commission. Sununu wants the AG's chief of staff, Diane Martin, to lead the commission. She's currently the state lead attorney on civil contracts and procurements. Martin's nomination is expected to go up for an executive council vote in September. And governors from a handful of East Coast states, including New Hampshire, want the federal government to speed up its permitting of the Vineyard Wind Project. The $2.8 billion, 800-megawatt wind farm would be built off the coast of Massachusetts. It would be the first commercial-scale wind project in U.S. federal waters. The Departments of Interior and Commerce said this month they would give the project more environmental scrutiny than was expected, and that could result in a delay. Also, this week, this is the five-year anniversary of the story that captivated the country, Market Basket, the beloved grocery store here in New Hampshire. Kevin, you took a look at the six-week standoff that happened 5 years ago. What was so unusual about this story?
You know, what's really crazy about this story is that consumers shop by habit. They know the aisles. They know where all the products are. They're looking for dependable, reasonable prices. So what happened 5 years ago when a very nonetheless popular CEO got summarily fired in a family feud at the Market Basket chain, employees essentially walked off the job and refused to work. And then those employees called on customers to essentially boycott Market Basket, and it worked. And that's what I mean, is that it's unthinkable that if today we went out on Main Street and said, stop shopping at Walmart because we don't like the color on the outside of the store, people would not respond. But this touched a nerve. And Market Baskets, and it's unprecedented in corporate America. It's one of these cases that rarely happens. I mean, Market Basket's retail income fell by 90% during this six-week standoff. And Governors Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire at the time and Deval Patrick in Massachusetts at the time stepped in when the management that had taken over after the fired CEO essentially canned all the middle managers who refused to show up for work. At that point, they hosted a meeting at former Governor Patrick's vacation home in the Berkshires. It was supposed to last for an hour. It went on for 4 hours. Hassan was a lot of folks may not know this, but Hassan was a labor law attorney who was very involved in arbitration matters and was very familiar with these labor management disputes. And she confided in our story she'd never seen the level of hostility and animosity that existed between these two cousins.
Mm-hmm.
Of
the two cousins who own
of the Demoulas family. I mean, that's the Demoulas family, which kind of originated in Lowell, was a storied political family. I used to work for Lowell Sun in my previous life and in this business. And the godfather of the Demoulas family, named Telemachus Demoulas, who ran the empire, who founded the empire from a single grocery store, now there's 71 of them, was this Greek godfather in Lowell. Nothing mm-hmm. happened in politics unless Telemachus Demoulas said it was okay. He was singularly responsible for the meteoric rise of a politician named Paul Tsongas, who ended up, of course, running for president, winning the first in the nation primary, becoming a U.S. senator in Massachusetts, and a champion for deficit reduction. So,
Kevin, can I interrupt you for a minute? Like, because it is so unusual for people to have such brand loyalty to a CEO, and so why did people care so much about this CEO?
Well, I think one of the reasons they did was because Market Basket wasn't unionized, but they treated their employees extremely well. And there was, all employees got a profit sharing program. All employees could bid for a scholarship program for their employees and their family members. They had they had a reputation for always promoting from within in all these 71 stores. So what you ended up with was upper management people, a lot of these stores who had been there for decades, and shoppers, regular shoppers at Market Basket, knew these managers, knew these supervisors. These supervisors knew their customers. They knew he likes his pork loin lean, you know, and so it was part of the shopping experience that you had this personal connection with a lot of these employees. So when these supervisors walked off and said, support RDD, the culture of Market Basket is at stake, customers said, okay. Now, this thing couldn't have gone on forever. And former governor, now Senator Hassan, talked about how in the few weeks before that meeting that she convened, everywhere she went, people were getting anxious and people were saying, when is Market Basket going to reopen? You know, my budget is taking a real hit, Governor. You've got to do something about this. So it was the kind of dispute that really could have happened, but I don't think it could have gone on much longer before some customers may have voted for their feet and wanted and demanded Market Basket be reopened with whoever was running it.
Well, Kevin, we've got a link to your story up at nhpr.org. Listeners, feel free to check it out in detail. It's a fascinating story. Dean, your thoughts?
Yeah, just real quick. I think part of what was at stake here is really almost a nostalgia for a bygone retail shopping culture or experience, you know, in an age of large consolidating corporations and people not staying in jobs for 10 or 20 or 30 years anymore. There was a feeling that this was a potential loss of a type of consumer experience that people wanted to hold on to, almost kind of a Main Street experience where people knew your name, knew what you liked, and you don't see that as much anymore. And I felt almost like there was sort of a throwback nostalgia. People didn't want to let go of that kind of culture that is increasingly rare among big corporations.
Heading into this Labor Day weekend, we are reviewing the news of the week, the news that mattered to New Hampshire. Give us a call if you have questions or comments, 1-800-892-6477, or send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. When we come back, we'll talk with political reporter Paul Steinhauser about the latest in the 2020 campaign. There's been a lot happening. We'll get the details from him. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week. In the studio with me, Kevin Landrigan, reporter for the Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and joining us for this part of the program, Paul Steinhauser, New Hampshire-based political reporter who writes for Fox News, The Concord Monitor, and Seacoast Online. Paul, thanks very much for joining us.
Always great to be back here.
We've got a ton of questions for you because you've been on the ground following the candidates around, as many as you can, actually. You can't be in several places at once, but you do your best. So, Paul, the next debate between the candidates for the Democratic nomination for president have only 10 candidates. Who's on the stage this time around?
I'm glad you asked. Here you go. Former Vice President Joe Biden. He's been the front runner since he jumped into the race in late April. He'll be there. But this is all by alphabetical order. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro, who was also San Antonio, Texas mayor, Senator Kamala Harris of California, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, former Congressman Beto O'Rourke of Texas, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, we know him quite well, and Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, and finally, tech entrepreneur Andrew Yang, who in recent months has really started to surge. One night only, because there's only 10 candidates. Remember, the first two rounds of debates, we had 20 candidates, but they raised the thresholds for this third round and for the fourth round, and that meant about half the field did not make the cut.
So the DNC sets the threshold. What was it this time around?
Campaign contributions from 130,000 individual donors. That's double what the first two rounds were. And then 2%, polling 2% in four polls, but not just any polls. There was about 15 or 16 polls that the Democratic National Committee considered qualifying polls.
They're like national polls and then early state polls, like polls for here in Iowa.
Exactly. But one of the complaints from the candidates who didn't make it was there weren't enough polls. Take New Hampshire, for instance. Mm. Only I think since the last debate, there have not been any qualifying polls in New Hampshire.
Yeah, the problem is that the complaint that Paul's talking about is that there are too many national polls. It's much harder to get state polls because it's expensive and the state outlets don't have the resources. You know, you're maybe getting something once a month. And you know, one other glitch getting at Paul's comments about qualifications, they're the same qualifications for the October debate. So in theory, Tom Steyer, who just missed, I think, by one poll. And Tulsi Gabbard, who was on the bubble as well, they could be back in October, which would bring us up to 12. Now, subsequent debates, the threshold's going to get even higher, so we will have an additional winnowing. But we could go from 10 in September to 12 in October. My preference would be to split them up and have 2 5-person debates, but everybody seems eager to have all of them on the same
stage.
They
haven't put you in charge yet.
I know.
Unfortunately.
No one's listening to me on that, so we're going to go with yet another...
Bonus for Dean, I'm sorry.
We're going to have yet another 10... Another 10 on the stage, which, you know, it would be nice to see. It'd be nice to see Warren and Biden and Sanders on the same stage, et cetera. But it's just tough with 10 people.
Yeah. Well, Paul, who's dropped out so far? We've had a few candidates sort of throw in the towel.
Right. Because we had a record-setting field. We've never seen this. It was historic. We were up to about 24 candidates at one time. But Eric Swalwell, the congressman from California, dropped out back in July. 2 weeks ago, John Hinkenlooper, the former Colorado governor, two-term governor, he dropped out and jumped into the U.S. Senate race there where the Democrats hope they can knock out a Republican. Last week, we had two people drop out. Jay Inslee, the Democratic two-term governor of Washington State, he immediately announced he was going to run for a third term. And right over the border here in the 6th Congressional District of Massachusetts, Seth Moulton dropped out, announced he would be running for re-election. This week, hours before that deadline to reach those criteria to make the debate, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, she also called it quits and now returns to her day job in the U.S. Senate.
Okay, so in your educated opinion, Paul, who might be next to drop out? Or is that not something you'd like to say publicly?
Well, I made the rounds of calls to all the campaigns just in the last day or two since the numbers came out on who was going to make the third round. Nobody else seems to be dropping out right now because, as Dean was saying, it's the same criteria for the fourth round. So we know Gabbard and Steyer are going to stick around because they'll probably make it. And some of the other candidates as well, or at least for now, are saying they are sticking in. And their argument is this. It's not the Democratic National Committee's job to winnow the field. They say the job is for Iowa voters and New Hampshire voters, the early voting states. So they're very upset about this. But at the same time, the other argument is we have way too many candidates. We need to concentrate on those who really have a chance of beating Donald Trump. It's a good time, they say, to narrow and winnow the field.
Well, let's talk about former Vice President Joe Biden, because he's leading the pack as he pretty much has been since he entered the race. Mm-hmm. He was in New Hampshire this week. He spoke at Keene State College this week.
We have to reach beyond our party, in my view. We have to unify the country, and we have to restore the soul of the nation. You know, we have to be what we once were again. We never fully lived up to our obligations. But we never walked away from them before. We never abandoned them completely. But we have to be a nation that values honesty and decency, treating everyone with respect and dignity, giving everyone a fair shot, leaving nobody behind, giving hate no safe harbor, demonizing no one, not the poor, the immigrant, the other, as is happening now, and lending the power of our example. Not just the example of our power, lead that way. And standing as a beacon for the world, remembering that we're part of something bigger than ourselves.
So, Paul, you've been keeping an eye on the Biden campaign. What's the state of it right now?
Here in this state, you know, they've got a robust campaign staff. Equal to some of the other top tier contenders. In the polls, there haven't been a lot here, but he remains the front runner. His margins are not as large as nationally, but he does remain the front runner. This was his most recent trip. It was last Friday in Hanover up at Dartmouth College and then in Croydon, and then he spent Saturday in Keene. That was a little taste right there of his stump speech, but at least nationally, the storyline was more gaffes for Joe Biden because of what he said in Hanover when he was talking about RFK and Martin Luther King, two of his political heroes, and he harkened back to their assassinations in 1968. And he said, hypothetically, imagine what would have happened if President Obama was assassinated during the 2008 election. Well, that instantly became the big headline when I was writing my story for Fox News, Washington Post, New York Times, CNN, whatever. And that stepped on what he was trying to do. It was a healthcare town hall. Mm. Then the next day in Keene, he was asked a very softball question by a local reporter there. How do you like Keene? And he talked about it, but he said it's, you know, what not to like about here in Vermont. Well, again, that feeds that narrative that maybe he's lost a little bit on his fastball.
And that worries some people because he's going to have to be very, very sharp if he's going to be debating President Trump.
Exactly. It gave Republicans a little early Christmas gift to once again attack him as not being fit. And your point is accurate. And then just this week, a new story coming up off that trip. He told a very gripping story in Hanover about pinning the medal on a heroic member of the military in Afghanistan while he was vice president. Gripping story. The crowd was totally into it. I was there and I was watching. And it was a powerful moment. Now it seems, after some reporting from The Washington Post, that there were a number of inaccuracies in that story. And, of course, that dominated national headlines in the last day or two. All this said, it's a very different story when you talk about the local reporting. You know, my story for the Concord Monitor was very different than what I wrote for Fox News. If you look at the other coverage from the local stations like WMUR and WCAX and the Valley News, very different. So I wonder how much voters are really paying attention to the gaffes.
One last issue we should talk about with respect to Joe Biden, which is that, speaking of national press, the New York Times wrote this week of women lining up to hug Joe Biden, a seeming act of defiance against an aspect of the Me Too movement and the many women who have accused Biden of not atoning for alleged unwanted touching. Others have pointed out he hasn't truly atoned for the unwanted touching that he's been accused of. So I wanted to ask you, Paul, to what extent is this a factor in Biden's candidacy?
I don't think it's as much of a storyline right now as it was earlier. Kevin and I were up in Berlin. Right. Remember that moment?
Yeah, I do.
What moment
was that? I'm sorry.
Back in Berlin. Remember the story? Yeah.
Right. Up in Berlin, he had a town hall about energy, but it was right after that. And it was right after a lot of that controversy had occurred. And there were people at that event who were sort of lining up to hug him. And you could see him be very careful about his space around women. And I think the campaign, trust me, their campaign is laser focused on not having an inappropriate hug by this candidate with a female supporter. But you can't stop supporters from trying to change the narrative. And that's obviously what women supporters of Biden are trying to do.
Other stories we've reported this week worth mentioning before we get back to the 2020 campaign. Governor Chris Sununu says Merrimack County Sheriff Scott Hilliard has been removed from his Judicial Selection Commission. Hilliard this week pleaded not guilty to aggravated drunk driving charges and having an open container with alcohol. Hilliard's removal was announced during an executive council meeting where Sununu faced questions on the workings of his Judicial Selection Commission. Also, a mosquito-borne illness has been found in a horse in New Hampshire. Health officials say eastern equine encephalitis was found in a horse in Northwood. They've raised the risk level for Tripoli and Northwood to high and surrounding towns as well, and that will increase from low to moderate. There have been no human cases of Tripoli identified this year in New Hampshire. The illness can cause serious neurological symptoms and death. All right, back to 2020 for a moment. Paul, candidate Andrew Yang was in New Hampshire this week. He's one of the 10, as you mentioned, who's going to be on the debate stage on September 12th, I believe it is. He was promoting his climate change plan. What did you make of that plan, Paul? What are the details there?
Higher ground. One of the themes of his plan is a move to higher ground. It's got a lot of similar components than that the other rivals for the nomination have put out in their climate change plans. Almost everybody has one. Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, who's also made the debate stage, she also came to New Hampshire to highlight her plan as well. Yang is fascinating, though. Here's a guy that nobody had heard of a year and a half ago when he first jumped into the race. Even in March or April, he was still considered the longest of long shots. But I think in part because of what he's been pushing, that universal basic income, he calls it a freedom dividend, $1,000 a month to every adult American. That's really generated a lot of buzz. And now he's done what sitting senators and governors couldn't do, make the debate stages. He's easily qualified. It was a beautiful moment. He was in Portsmouth right at sea level to announce his plan with the Piscataqua River right behind us. But he's very optimistic. I'm not saying he's getting cocky, but he's definitely getting confident. I had a chance to interview him. He's very confident of where he stands right now in this race for the White House.
Kevin Landry.
I was just going to say, I don't know if Dean feels this way, too. I think Yang, more than any candidate in this race, has captured the insecurity that Americans have about automation and the impact it's having on this economy. That future, that hundreds of thousands of workers could be threatened by the greater and greater use of automation, and something needs to be done to shore up the middle class.
Yeah, well, I think for him, clearly he is increasingly comfortable with the idea that he's going to be in the mix for a while going forward. Whether he's going to jump from 3 or 4% up into the top tier remains to be seen. You know, it's interesting, as a side note, some candidates have been pushing for a DNC debate just on climate. The DNC declined to do that. They prefer to have climate change being woven into the discussion of other issues. So there is real concern about that, about whether or not the DNC is giving enough time to the issue of climate change. But, you know, he's been a really interesting voice. He's someone who Republicans would likely caricature as socialist. You know, he gave everybody a guaranteed income. So he would have to deal with that down the road. But he clearly has tapped into some of this economic anxiety. And he'll be an interesting addition to the mix. Often criticized for being the only candidate on the debate stage not wearing a tie. We'll see if he can continues on with that. So he's in the mix going forward. I don't know that he's going to jump up into the top 4 or 5, but he's an interesting voice.
Paul, Senator Bernie Sanders is scheduling several trips to towns in New Hampshire and Maine. Where's he going to be, and are you going to be there?
I will be there, and it's Labor Day weekend. Remember, Sanders has really been making a hard push for labor. He'll be marching, among other things, when he's here on Sunday and Monday. He'll be marching in Milford's annual Labor Day parade. Kevin, that's probably the biggest Labor Day parade in the
state. Got to be there. You got to be there if you're politicking on Labor Day weekend.
So it's going to be a long parade, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth Warren's also popping in this weekend for a real quick house party in Hampton Falls on Monday. But we get everybody here the following weekend for the annual Democratic State Party Convention. The entire field will be here in New Hampshire.
Okay, so we have a firm sense of Paul's schedule. I want to know what Dean and Kevin are looking forward to next week. Let's start with you, Kevin. What are you going to be doing?
Yeah, there are going to be more budget talks, and we're certainly going to be focused on them. And obviously, another month has passed, so that means August revenues are out. It's not a big month, but another signal of whether this economy is slowing, whether there's going to be enough revenue to support the next state budget deal.
How about you, Dean? What's going on next week?
We got the presidential debate down the road a little bit. That's actually on September 12th. But there's a lot of talk and a lot of interest, as Paul mentioned, about the state Democratic convention, which is going to be at the SNHU Arena. And then the wild card I'm still watching is whether or not former Trump campaign manager Corin Lewandowski is going to jump into the Republican primary to challenge Senator Jeanne Shaheen. A lot of people think he will, but he hasn't done it as of yet.
That's Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. We're also joined today by senior reporter for the Union Leader, Kevin Landrigan, and New Hampshire-based political reporter for Fox News, The Concord Monitor, and Seacoast Online, Paul Steinhauser. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter. Thank
you.
And remember, listeners, we've got all the links to the stories we've discussed today at our website at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great Labor Day weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.